It's a great time to save big on everything for your next project at Menards. Get free estimates fast on new energy-efficient windows from Jeld-Wen. Choose from vinyl or wood windows and customize the perfect size and unique features for your home. Save big on all Jeld-Wen windows today. View our entire selection of Jeld-Wen windows on Menards.com. Plus, the weekly flyer for other great deals happening now.
Save big money at
It's a great time to save big on everything for your next project at Menards. Get free estimates fast on new energy-efficient windows from Jeld-Wen. Choose from vinyl or wood windows and customize the perfect size and unique features for your home. Save big on all Jeld-Wen windows today. View our entire selection of Jeld-Wen windows on Menards.com. Plus, the weekly flyer for other great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Heard Tell.
Welcome back to Heard Tell. I'm so happy to be talking to my buddy Alex. We're going to practice the name in just a second. See, I already messed it up. We were going to practice it. Marishu.
That's a little close. Morishanu.
Morishanu. Okay. Morishanu. Alex Morishanu. He's at A Hard to Spell at Twitter. Get it. So we call him Alex Hard to Spell. We go way back, all the way back to the Young Voices day, even though we're not that young anymore, buddy. Good to see you. Good to talk to you again. How you been?
Doing well. Doing well. Glad to be here.
He does tax policy stuff, and that's where I wanted to start because we are kind of in what I call policy silly season of the election. You have silly season during the primaries where people are just throwing it. We have our candidates now. We're going to have the DNC this coming week, so that'll be a little more serious. But we are in the silly season of policy where the candidates just start throwing out the populist stuff that sounds really good but doesn't have a lot of policy to it. So before we get to the tax stuff, how's it hit you? Because you take this stuff seriously. You're one of those people that just, you know, like pain and suffering and get into the tax code and that sort of thing. You've noticed this trend, right, though, that something really complex like tax code, like tax policy, the buzzwords of it, the policy of it. And now we have both major candidates just going off with the buzzwords of the policies. And you're like, no, wait a minute. This isn't good policy, or this is a good policy. It just doesn't have a good buzzword. You've noticed this trend, right?
Yeah. And honestly, I think, you know, at some level, this is a constant of politics that, you know, politicians will say what sounds good or sounds appealing, but isn't really backed up by a, you know, more thorough evaluation of the issues, you know, pander to the lowest common denominator, whatever. That's constant. You expect that in politics. But I think in terms of how campaigns, I think, approach tax policy, I think it has actually gotten worse. If you go back to, say, the 2016 primary, you had these very detailed policy proposals on both sides of the aisle. You know, every Republican in 2016 had a tax plan. You know, the Democratic side also very detailed. And maybe, you know, maybe not all those ideas were good, but they were at least approached with a level of thoughtfulness and consideration for, you know, what the tax code should look like. Whereas, you know, I think a lot of the policies that we're seeing from both campaigns are sort of slapped together, not reflective of like a deeper engagement with the substantive, you know, question of what should the tax code look like.
And how do we deal with substantive? Because part of your job is you can do the code stuff and all the in-depth reading on it, but then you've got to write an article about it, or you got to do a little video on it, or you do an interview like you're doing with me where you have to explain it in these little, this really complex, multi-layered stuff that is really, let's call it what it is. It's become this Frankenstein of a lot of different stuff slapped together, right? That's a fair way to put it. And you have to try to explain in little 2, 3, 4, 5 minute sound bites. That's the inherent problem with all policy. Where it comes different with tax policy is this, taxes is the one thing all Americans have in common. You either have to pay it or you at least have to announce it. This is the one policy that it's almost the most complex policy we have, but it's also one of the very few that actually affects every single person.
Absolutely. Although I will say when I was in college and I knew I wanted to go into public policy, but I wasn't sure sort of what issue area to specialize in, I was debating between tax policy and healthcare policy. And I decided, you know, actually tax policy is kind of easy to understand relative to healthcare. So maybe it's not the hardest issue, but it is like a sort of optimistic way to put this as Rich Rubin at the Wall Street Journal says, that every story has a tax angle. I think that's something that's really interesting about working in tax policy, is each issue, there's some tax provision that relates to it. Maybe it's not like the most important part of an issue, but it's certainly, you know, connected and relevant. You know, you can talk about how, I mean, take healthcare, the exclusion for employer-sponsored health insurance, you know, not being taxed, or, you know, compensation not taxed under the income tax. That has huge implications for health policy, but it's a tax decision. And I think on the subject of having to break down the sort of complex issue in sort of easy to understand sound bites, I mean, that is a challenge. I guess that's why I think at some level, like, that's my job. But it is always a balance of trying to make sure that you get the technical aspects correct, while also not, or like getting the technical aspects correct and also getting it into a format that people can digest. And you don't want to water the explanation too far down to where you're actually, you know, saying something that's substantively wrong. I think it's a fun challenge, though.
And it's important because, you know, if you care about government and you care about the country, most people are familiar with the Bill of Rights. They know the First Amendment. The First Amendment has those five essential freedoms, right? Speech, religion, assembly, freedom of the press, redress of grievances. People know that. Thing about the Constitution is the prime role of Congress is really the power of the purse. It's representing the people, but in people, it's representing the people's money, and taxation is the way that the people fund their government. So we talk about all this big stuff like national debt, or we're going to talk about infrastructure spending and all this. Taxation is really the most fundamental building block of a representative government, or even a dictatorship. That is, like, the people are going to pay for the government. We just don't talk enough about how foundation, that's really like the First Amendment of how the whole government's functioned, is tax policy, and yet we don't talk about it that way.
Yeah, I mean, at some level, I think of it as half of government. You have a spending side and you have a tax side, and spending side is all kinds of stuff, from infrastructure, social programs, entitlements, military and defense. All these issues are just one half of the equation, and taxes are the whole other side. I think that's absolutely, like, yeah, no matter what form of government, you're going to need to raise revenue one way or another, probably through taxes, unless you are a very weird, like, petro state, maybe. I absolutely agree.
Yeah, we could be a petro state, but that's another argument for another day.
Get 15% off a set of BrakeMess Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Let's do a couple pieces of nomenclature, though, because you're really smart. You can explain this stuff so easy that even I can understand it. But when we talk about taxes, there's some nomenclature that we hear in the news media and in commentary all the time. But I want to take a second and make sure we got the nomenclature right. So when somebody says a term like tax cut, well, everybody just thinks like, oh, that's paying less taxes. practically, though, that could mean a lot of different things. That could be moving piles of money from one source of revenue to another. That could be just rewriting a piece of the tax code so that it's a, you know, a regulation instead of a tax. We've seen that because that gets fought out in the court system. Something like a term like a tax cut, because we're going to be talking about that because it's election year. So it'll be raised taxes, tax cut. You're going to hear that dynamic. How should we approach when we hear the term tax cut? Give us a good definition of that as a news consumer.
That's a good question. I would say definition of a tax cut, I guess the important question is whether we're talking about an individual policy or a package. In 2017, we had the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which is often described as a $1.5 to $2 trillion tax cut. But it was not just, we're going to cut rates, we're going to cut tax rates, and we're going to introduce some new tax credits. It was a combination of tax cuts and tax increases that, when added up together, amounted to a net tax cut of between $1.5 and $2 trillion. But within that, that's really, you know, $5.5 or so trillion in tax cuts, and you know, $3.5 to $4 trillion in tax increases. It's a reform that results in a net tax cut. Whereas other policies might just be a sort of standalone. You might just be talking about something as a standalone thing, just increasing the child tax credit, like that would be a tax cut. Or you could just reduce the you know, income tax rates by each bracket by one percentage point each. You know, that would be a tax cut. That's one category. And then another category would be the sort of a broad reform that just, at the end of the day, on net results in less revenue, but includes both some tax increases and some tax cuts. And there are a lot of different types of ways to cut taxes or cut, you know, tax revenue. You could do credits, you could do increased deductions, you could lower rates. I think that's a good way to think about when people talk about tax cuts. They could be talking about a sort of big reform package where a lot of things change, or it could just be sort of one specific policy being changed.
The opposite of that one, of course, is we hear it all the time during election year. They want to raise your taxes. And it's kind of the mirror image of the same rhetoric, though, because raise your taxes can mean a lot of things, because the government grows because the country grows. So technically, your taxes are always going to raise just naturally, incrementally, no matter what. Your taxes raise as you go up in income. Your taxes may actually raise as you decrease income, depending on how it's outlined. There's a lot that goes into that, but that's the rhetoric we hear. They want to raise your taxes. What's a healthy way to come at that term?
I guess, yeah, it's a similar idea to what I talked about earlier. Now, about a tax cut, yeah, it's just about the mirror image. Sometimes you get a package that includes, you know, a combination of tax increases and tax cuts. We're going to reform the tax code. We're going to make it sort of better. We're going to improve its design. And along the way, we're going to raise the amount of revenue that we're taking in. Versus just like one discrete policy that is just like, we're going to raise, you know, the top income tax rate from 37% to 40%. And I mean, I think another part of this conversation is, I think there is a bit too much focus on, you know, how, or are we raising taxes or cutting taxes? And I think there should be a little bit more sort of thought put on how are we raising taxes and how are we cutting taxes, rather than just, you know, the direction.
Yeah. You just touched on it. There's another terminology that I want to touch on, because we're going to hear it a lot, especially with Donald Trump running, because he made his reputation as a businessman and a reality TV star. But you've heard it long before then. I remember the Ross Perot campaign. I'm old enough to remember that one where, we got to run government like a business. The terms are the same. Revenue, money coming in, right? Deficit, money loss. If you have more revenue than you have loss, you make, in the business world, we call it profit. In government, we call it surplus, but it's basically the same terminology. However, just saying run the government like a business isn't the same, because it's not, because businesses don't get to tax people. They're charging. It's a different thing. Talk about that rhetoric for a minute, because we hear that a lot of like, well, just run government like a business. The terminology is very similar, but it's not actually really super practical. And it almost leads you down a path where you don't fully understand. And it kind of gets us into that mess we talked about of it gets it overly complicated. And we get away from what taxation policy is really supposed to be, funding the government.
Yeah, I have very mixed feelings about run government like a business as both sort of a rhetorical matter and as a sort of guide for policymaking. I think the way that the idea could actually be kind of helpful is that it is a sort of public choice theory idea where government agencies want to maximize their budgets. And if a government agency is not doing its job, the instinct is to give them more money because you have some end goal that you're some policy goal you're trying to achieve. And if the agency is not fulfilling its role, or the program is not fulfilling its role, well, then we need to spend more on that program in order to make it work. And I think the thinking is that if you run a government like a business, you say this program costs a ton of money and is not giving us what we want, so we will get rid of it instead of spending more money on it. I think that is like a reasonable, like it depends on the circumstance. I mean, sometimes there's a program that like, I guess you are just going to have to spend more money because that goal is that important to you. But I think like a little bit of that mentality could be helpful. But, you know, I think government's finances are very different from a corporate, or, you know, in some ways very different from a corporation's finances. The difference between a government and a company is that, like you said, you know, businesses, revenue, those are voluntary payments made to them by customers, and governments have a monopoly on the use of force. They have to, you know, you have to pay them. And so I think that is like one of the ways in which I don't think it's a great analogy for how to think about running government and raising money. That being said, I think there is a certain like a business person has like a little bit better of an understanding of how companies make business decisions. And so maybe that influences their thinking on how to design the tax code, because they do consider, you know, the behavior, you know, they have a better understanding of how businesses respond to incentives. Now that maybe might be true, you know, but I don't think that like the businesses and government are like strictly transferable in terms of how they operate.
Yeah, that brings us to this no tax on tips thing. I think this is such a fun, teachable moment because I don't remember too many things where this has happened. So we have the two major party candidates agreeing on something, which that's odd enough on it is. So there's bipartisan agreement between them. There's some bipartisan agreement in Congress, especially the U.S. Senate. Ted Cruz and a couple others have a bill about this already, and Trump kind of glommed onto it. Trump saying this is his idea. This actually goes all the way back to 83. Reagan first proposed this in the tax codes back then. So this has a long history of talking about this. But there's also bipartisan agreement against it. I can't remember a thing where there's bipartisan amongst the politicians and the policy wonks who really fight about this stuff, who never agree on anything. They all agree it's a bad idea. What say you? Because it sounds really good. No tax on tips, which pay them in cash. They're not going to pay those taxes anyway. Shh, don't tell anybody. But the no tax on tips sounds good, but then you disagreed with it at writing for Tax Foundation. American Prospect, who probably isn't going to publish you anytime soon, they agreed with you, although you two came to it from two different angles. You wound up at the same place. I don't remember an issue ever looking like this, where there's so much bipartisan agreement and disagreement at the same time. Walk us through it a little bit, because the buzzword sounds good, but the practicality of it has a lot of technical details and a lot of devil in those details.
Yeah. I mean, as far as like why this issue has like been brought forward, because it was not on many people's radar, I think, in recent years. Trump comes out for this idea in Nevada. Nevada's got a lot of tip workers. Nevada's a swing state. Kamala later then comes out for the idea. You don't need a slide rule to figure out like why both of them, I think, have come together on this issue in an election year where this might be a decisive state. But as far as like a policy matter, there's like the root justification. I mean, yes, I think some people will, of course, benefit from this policy. Somebody benefits from virtual landing policy you enact. It's a very large country. But the idea that, you know, tipped income specifically shouldn't be taxed, and just about any other form of compensation should remain taxed, just isn't a policy problem or like policy view that I think has ever been articulated or held. And beyond that, though, it's sort of an interesting question of what would the effects of this policy be by treating one set of labor income differently than another. I think that is like an interesting question, setting aside that, like, well, why are we trying to do this? I don't see a good reason for it, but if enacted, I think it would be interesting, but still not a good idea.
It's interesting, the last part you said, because I think it gets to the core of when you hear something like no tax on tips or any kind of a tax policy, you know, buzzword that somebody's proposing, it gets to what you just said is, how do you treat labor and how are you going to tax labor? There's almost this thing, and there's been a big debate about service workers, and it always swerves into minimum wage and that sort of thing. But I think that's almost one side of the issue. And the other side of the issue is, why do we have this conversation? And tax policy goes directly to this. Service workers that are tipped, now all of a sudden you're saying, well, they need to be compensated in a certain way that other people aren't. And then you get into the debate of, well, who should be compensated in that same way? That's one of those little intricacies that you look at that the buzzword doesn't look at as like, oh, well, it's just a natural habit for a normal person to have a waiter or somebody at the hotel or whatever the case may be, your Uber driver or whatever, and you tip them a little bit, or somebody carries something to your car and you tip them. That's a natural human behavior that's part of our culture. But if you put that into the tax code, it's not a human nature thing. It's a black and white legality that has to be very, very, very specific. And now you're into things like big words that you use when you sit in your tank and think and do that sort of thing, incentivizing and those sorts of things. That's the disconnect between the rhetoric and you're saying, oh, well, of course we want these people to make more money, but it's also how they make more money is how you're treating them as a part of labor and as people individually also.
Yeah. And I think there are a lot of questions again, because this idea hasn't been, I had a question from a reporter saying, have any states tried something like this before? And I didn't know off the top of my head. And I asked a couple colleagues of mine who work on state tax policy. And I said, have you heard of anything about this at the state level, maybe historically? And these guys who know a whole lot about state tax history said, nope, not that I could think of. So I think there are some interesting like dynamics that you could imagine resulting from this policy. Now, the first point to talk about is that, you know, the vast majority of lower and middle income workers are not tipped workers. A good chunk of tipped workers actually wouldn't necessarily benefit from this policy either, because a lot of them are sort of part-time, high school kids working after school, that sort of thing. And their total income with tips is under the standard deduction. So they are already not paying personal income tax because their income doesn't reach that level. So the fact that they're also able to deduct, you know, tipped income wouldn't change their tax liability because they're already at the lowest level possible. But there are some interesting dynamics where do you introduce, does tipping get introduced in like more occupations? Do more occupations start having as a custom a tip because it's tax advantaged? Now, tipping has like very particular rules. Like it's supposed to be like a tip is voluntary, given to you by the customer. You cannot agree to it in advance. The example that somebody used when it was a Trump policy idea that I think they would have backed off. Maybe they backed off on it. Maybe they haven't. Is that if you introduce this policy, then you know, a hedge fund manager could just say, give me all my compensation and tips. Yeah. And so they would see a huge tax cut, right? And it's like, well, you can't agree to a tip in a contract. I think that would defeat the idea of tip. That would make it, therefore, not tipped income. But you could imagine that, you know, it becoming customary, I don't know, to give a tip to your doctor or something, that's like a direct like customer service provider interaction. I could imagine something like that. You know, I don't know. I live in an apartment. I've never thought or I've never had to hire a landscaper, but maybe, you know, it becomes, and I don't know actually if it's customary to tip landscapers, but maybe it becomes customary now. Then the other side is that because now these tipped occupations have this tax advantage, maybe more people want to work as waiters. And this competition sort of drives down the you know, increase of labor supply in the waiter market, makes people drives down aggregate wages for waiters because, you know, tips are taxed less. And so the possibilities there are higher. So you want, like, more people want to go into it. That is also a dynamic that I could imagine happening. But I guess like the point is like, why would we particularly want any of these effects to happen? If you want to cut taxes for like lower middle income workers, you can just cut taxes for lower middle income workers broadly. Not a lot on some subset.
This is a good point to talk about something else in tax policy that, look, policy, people want to talk broad policy because it gets a broad audience and more people. This, I think, would be a really good example of policy that should be localized because when Kamala Harris pitched this, she's doing it, it's an arena thing, but she's standing in front of Culinary Local 262. The Culinary Union in Vegas runs Vegas, okay? Everybody understands, you know, the casinos and all the stuff that supports them. I lived in Vegas for a couple of years. The Culinary Union is the powerful force in that town. So it would make sense to them because they, you know, that's who they work on. Almost a lot of their employees are customer-facing that get things like tips. This seems like one of those things where you go, okay, this would be a really good idea in Orlando, in Las Vegas, maybe in LA, maybe in, you know, Cherokee, North Carolina, where there's a big casino, maybe Biloxi, Mississippi, you know, entertainment hubs. Okay, this could probably be argued in a policy. And we already mentioned, you know, there's some bipartisan agreement for and against this. This should be a localized thing. This probably wouldn't work really good in downtown Cincinnati, or it may not work really good in, you know, Austin, Texas, or wherever. Do we not talk enough about, like, hey, some tax policy probably should just be more on the local and state level and quit trying to scale absolutely everything to national? Now, to be fair to both candidates, they're scaling everything national because they're trying to get elected president. So I understand why they discuss it that way. But shouldn't the voters maybe demand, especially at the state and the local level, even at the county and city levels, and go like, hey, wait a minute, shouldn't our tax policy be kind of dovetailed into what we're dealing with right here? Like, you know, my small town is a tourist area. So they would probably have to have some kind of a touristy centered tax policy because you got a lot of tourists in the summer and not a lot in the winter, right? Go down the road to Fayetteville, West Virginia, huge new national park. having a national park park itself right beside you and take over your money-making venture, that changes your tax policy and revenue. I know, because I write for the paper there, right? Stuff like that, do we not talk about that enough? Is that something voters, just average people, should be like, wait a minute, let's talk about local tax policy more than the national tax policy, because one, we can affect it a lot easier, and two, it's actually going to affect us directly.
I think absolutely, and I also think that that's good illustration for the downsides of this sort of very targeted policy is that it hits a lot of different regions very differently. It provides a big benefit to Las Vegas. Las Vegas would see a pretty big share of the tax cut, I think, Cincinnati or Oklahoma City, you know, probably not as much. And I think that sort of narrow targeting of a specific region or a specific industry or industries, and then as a result, because industries are not equally distributed across the United States, specific regions, I think those sorts of tax policy designs are detrimental to having like a broad, you need to have a broad system that works for everybody, and it's designed with everybody in mind, not with narrow sort of interest groups, appealing to narrow interest groups. And so I think unfortunately, I think that's been lost. I think both sides in different ways are particularly concerned with targeting, so like the Inflation Reduction Act and the CHIPS Act, there are a lot of provisions meant to guide investments towards certain, you know, regions. Usually there's a sort of veneer of policy justifications that has to do with historically manufacturing heavy areas or historically, you know, focused on fossil fuel areas to try and make sure that like that they can benefit from the green transition and make sure that they can get some green jobs. But, you know, in reality, if you look at it, the states and areas that it's targeting seem suspiciously similar to swing states. It just happened to end up like that. I don't know. So I think that sort of shenanigan is better avoided with broad rules rather than sort of narrow subsidies.
Yeah, it makes sense. Let's talk about one way people do see their tax dollars a lot, because they put up big signs with it on it. I've got a new interstate spur going by the house out here, and there's a big old sign, you know, part of the Inflation and Jobs Act, right? It's big old sign right on it, and it's not even fully opened yet. This is age old, of course. If you don't fill the potholes, you're probably not going to get reelected at the local level. And if you don't, you know, spend on infrastructure on a national level, you get attacked on it. But infrastructure spending and tax dollars are always going to be linked. Now, we can get into the deficit spending and stuff like that, but this is another example of people, because infrastructure is a national issue down to the local issue. Everybody's got to deal with infrastructure, right? We did the infrastructure stuff under Trump a lot, obviously Biden and some of his policy proposals. What do you think the future is that? Because we're seeing more and more change in how infrastructure is being spent. That affects tax dollars. And the other part of the infrastructure thing is it's massive money into the private sector with these public-private, because you got to have a big company to build an interstate. You got to have a pretty major construction company to build a bridge. We've got some ports that are way out of date, need to be worked on. We got thousands of miles of rail line that are really out of date. But companies are going to get money, and the government's going to pick and choose who gets those contracts. This all goes right into tax policy, though, because that's our money getting spent. And that's the expenditure that people really, really notice and the politicians love to talk about. But we don't always tie that to the tax policy, do we?
Yeah, and so I think historically we did, and it's something we do less and less of. Historically, we've focused, and I'm going to talk, you know, primarily about roads here, applies to some degree for other modes of transportation as well. But historically, you know, we financed roads with taxes related to roads. The idea being that we're going to align some of the benefits of the taxes that fund roads to the people who benefit from roads. And to some extent, everybody does. And those taxes are also passed through. So a good example here is the gas tax that falls on people who drive, but it also is to some degree, you know, for commercial travel, it's passed through in the cost of transporting goods and services across the economy. So I don't own a car, but I do benefit from roads. And at some level, economically speaking, I pay the gas tax because other people who sell goods and services to me pay the gas tax because they've got to move those goods and services around. And we used to do this. This was how we funded the interstate highway system, you know, this big public investment. But we sort of still financed a lot of that with these targeted, you know, taxes focused on the users of roads. And today, we haven't touched the gas tax since 1993. In addition to that, you know, the gas tax is becoming, not only because of inflation has the gas tax declined in value, but also we've got electric vehicles coming, and they don't pay the gas tax, obviously, or, you know, they don't directly pay the gas tax. And how, you know, we've just gone to, we're just going to spend more from general fund. We're just going to plow whatever, revenue we get, from income taxes, corporate income taxes, into infrastructure instead of focusing on these narrow policies focused on users, and I mean, I say that we're using general revenue. I mean, I think at some level, what we're really doing is we're borrowing. That's what we're using the fund infrastructure, not the general fund revenue. We don't raise enough general fund revenue to fund everything else. So the gap's, I think, really being made up by borrowing. And I think that's a mistake. I think that is particularly true in roads. We actually do basically fund our airport infrastructure, and airway sort of, FAA type regulatory, oversight. We fund that basically through taxes and fees on, airlines and air travel. Air travelers. I think that's pretty like reasonably well set up. There are some improvements that could be made, but it's roads where we've diverged.
Yeah. One other thing that's interesting to me is we've heard it a little bit, but a lot of people are being very quiet about it. And I think they're being quiet on purpose. I'll give you my theory on it, but the tax cuts from the Trump administration are up to expire. Now there's a lot of debate over what they did do, didn't do. We'll get into that, but I've got a theory on this because the last thing you want to do in election year is talk about raising taxes, and expiring tax cuts are a raise on tax, no matter how you want to cut it. And the Republicans know they can't really do anything about it. They're going to end up doing a CR and an omnibus bill because that's all they can do now, and they're not going to get anything passed. So they don't want to take another L on what's been a really ugly legislative season for them. So I think everybody's just kind of ignoring it and hoping the field of play changes and they can deal with it next year before it expires. This is a big deal. And very, very few people are talking about the fact that this thing's got a clicking clock on it. No, that's not a word. A ticking clock on it, if I say it correctly. But I don't hear anybody talking about it. And I found that very, very strange, although understandable when you kind of think about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big issue. I think if you wanted to extend everything that's expiring in 2025 and you would make it permanent, it would cost, you know, somewhere between $3.5 and $4 trillion over a decade. That's a pretty damn big policy. You know, in terms of scale, no tax on tips is roughly $100 billion over 10 years. So you've got a policy that is between 35 and 40 times, I think, as large in scale as no tax on tips. But let me tell you, I have received more emails about no tax on tips expressing opinions just from random readers or curious taxpayers. I've received more emails related to no tax on tips than any other piece that I've ever written. People have a lot of opinions about this policy, and I think there are a lot of downsides to this policy. Like, I don't think it's a great idea, but it's not that big of a policy. And I think it has like absorbed like a huge amount of attention relative to the tax expirations next year, which are massive. It is a big effing deal, as our president once said.
Why is it such a big deal, though? Because when this was passed, look, there's a lot of politics involved, because, you know, it was Trump that did it and it's hot. And then, you know, Trump became a one-term president. So not being there, you know, Biden's not going to tout it. So a lot of this is circumstances of kind of how this kind of fell through the cracks a little bit. And we know the political, where they're not going to be able to do anything about it right now anyway. What did this tax cuts almost a little bit misleading on what all this involved, because this was really some rewriting of the tax code more than a cut. This was what we talked about earlier, changing some things that were regulatory. Get us past that buzzword, because everybody knows that it's the Trump tax cuts, or he cut taxes on the rich, or whatever you want to say. What did it actually do? So if it expires, what's actually going to happen?
Yeah, so I think, let me try and get it into like a nice clean number that I can break it into maybe three categories and say, you know, one, you need to know this, two, you need to know this, two, three, you need to know this. I guess on the personal income tax, 2 points, you reduced tax rates across the board, basically, you reduced the brackets, tax rates on the brackets. And to pay for that, or at least to pay for some of that, the law restricted itemized deductions. So it reduced the amount of principal that's eligible for the mortgage interest deduction, limited the deductibility of state and local taxes. And then on family tax provisions, it expanded the child tax credit and expanded the standard deduction while getting rid of the personal exemption. This was a net simplification, and made the child tax credit more generous. And then on the corporate income tax side, it reduced the corporate tax rate in order to both incentivize investment and prevent profit shifting, which is sort of not, I think in some people's heads, those are sort of one and the same. But like profit shifting is just sort of a paper matter of companies, you know, move whatever profits they can report elsewhere into a lower tax jurisdiction. That's more of a paper activity rather than investment, which is like sort of a real, like we're building something. And lowering the corporate tax rate addresses both of those concerns. It also improved some deductions for capital investment, but also introduced a new penalty on R&D investment, which was meant to be a budget gimmick, not to go into effect, but it did end up going to effect. And I think a lot of people have egg on their faces for that. But nonetheless, I guess that's the big picture. Lowered tax rates, reduced personal reduced deductions for mortgage interest, bigger child tax credit, slightly simpler individual income tax, and lower corporate rate. The lower corporate rate, though, is permanent, so that is not changing. But some of the deductions for investment are.
One more thing on this tax thing before we let you go, though, is the long-term view, because the other problem with taxes is people just want to pay them between January and April and never think about them again until the next January or April, right? The country, though, doesn't work that way. Tax code's actually supposed to be written out 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20 years in advance, try to anticipate what's going on. The national debt is a big issue. Our spending gap is a big issue. Federal spending and trillions we've dumped into it in the last few years. Both parties, both kinds of presidents have dumped in this huge issue. math is math. There's no version of the future of this country where you're not going to have to raise taxes to fix the coming fiscal problems, especially with the social safety net issues, entitlements, those sorts of things. There's just no way around that. Now, they can musical chair this for a few more years maybe, but at some point you have to tax, or you're going to have another 100 million citizens, probably both, to balance the books on this stuff. But no politician is going to run for office, especially for president, going, oh, we got to raise taxes by X percent so we don't have a financial disaster on our hand. How can people start actually talking about that? And I know it's not fun. It's not sexy like people want to talk about. We'd rather do cat pictures and just yell at DC. But if we're going to start talking about an actual problem coming down the pike and the fact that raised taxes is going to be hard on everybody, but it's going to be the inevitable goal if we don't change what we're doing, what's a good way to talk about that in plain language for folks on their social media, just in things, and then in the rare opportunity they get to talk to a legislator or a congressperson or a presidential candidate?
I mean, I remember I was asked this question by somebody, guy who's like very, very concerned about the national debt, but he was asking me like, how do we talk to people about this issue and to get them to sort of take it seriously as a political priority. And I think I said it at some extent, like, if I knew, I would be a very highly paid political consultant. If I really knew, I mean, I think at some level, getting through that, it's not, do we make this hard policy choice now? It's, do we make a slightly less difficult policy choice now, or do we face a really tough one in 10 years? With the Social Security Trust Fund, it's not necessarily my specialty, the details of Social Security, but, you know, I think the rule is, you know, if the fund runs out, you have like an automatic benefit cut across the board that's pretty substantial. You could, if you get ahead of it, you can make it, you know, you can make a much more gentle change. You can protect, you know, lower income people who really rely on Social Security. You could protect them, if you get ahead of the issue. But if you don't, and you keep kicking the can down the road until it's really too late, you've got this across the board cut, staring you down. I think there's a similar story with taxes, albeit not with that sort of rule. But if you think about, you know, if you're thoughtful and maybe you develop a more efficient, you know, tax reform that, you know, does net raise revenue, but you do it in you get rid of some disincentives for investment along the way, so it doesn't hurt the economy too much, that, you know, is ultimately a net tax increase. You do that in advance, you're in a much better position. If you have to wait until the last minute, you're just going to be like, all right, we're just raising all the income taxes 10%, because that's what we got to do. And that's relatively straightforward, easy to understand. That's what we're going to do, because the S has hit the fan, and we need to raise money one way or another. I think if you get ahead of some of those topics, you can have a lot easier of a conversation than the really hard ones that you will have to have if we do get in trouble.
Yep. And when you get in trouble, send lawyers, guns, and money. You almost had the whole lyric in your answer anyway, so I'll just go ahead and lay that out there. Look, this stuff's complicated, and I appreciate you talking us through it. Give folks one or two things to look for in this coming campaign, because they're going to talk about taxes, because they're politicians. They always talk about taxes. And they're going to talk about policies. Give folks one or two things to kind of put their radar up when they hear either one of the candidates, whether it's Vice President Harris, former President Trump, when they're talking about policy and financial policy and tax policy. What's a couple of the buzzwords that pop your antenna up? Like, okay, they're saying that, but I need to look into what they actually mean by what they're saying. Give folks one or two things to watch for and pick out of the news cycle as it continues to spin faster and faster.
At least personally, what I try and think about when I read about policymakers' ideas, or I hear them talk, or I look at their website and their issues page, even sort of more dramatically, like a party platform. What I always try and figure out, and this is not like an exact science, is prioritization. I think that is what I'm most interested in when I look at trying to figure out what a politician would actually do in office. Politicians usually have a very long list of ideas. for what they're going to do. And realistically, if you're a president and you have, and you know, and you do have a Congress that is of the same party, you have control of government, you probably get 1 to 2 big policy reforms, legislative packages. What are you going to use those two chips on? And it's not, you know, usually they don't have, these are the two that I'm going to focus on, because they need to keep everybody on board. They say, you know, I'm going to do all this on the environment. I'm going to do all this on, you know, education and gun, you know, gun control and taxes and healthcare, you know, all of these different ideas. But when it comes down to the process of legislating, like, they're going to pick a couple of priorities. And so I think that is, I think, like, the most important thing to try and figure out is, like, where their priorities are. I think, I mean, I don't know. I'm done trying to predict what's going on in Donald Trump's brain. He's a real unpredictable guy. But you know, I think with Harris, I think something that is useful is looking back at what her priorities were when she ran for president in 2020 or in the 2020 primary. You know, she was more focused on, like, she endorsed a bunch of different big tax increases. She wanted to raise the corporate rate back to 35%. She, I think, supported a financial transactions tax, or, you know, a bunch of other things. But, like, the idea that was really, like, her core issue was just sort of a big middle class tax credit, which I didn't think was particularly well designed. I think, you know, if you want to do tax relief, I'd rather reduce rates than have another, you know, credit to the code. But, like, that was her distinguishing policy. Like, everybody in that primary loved financial transactions taxes. Like, I don't think that's a uniquely Kamala Harris idea, but the middle class tax credit, I think something like that is more where her priorities might lie. So that's something I've been thinking about. Yeah, trying to figure out priorities is, I think, just as or more important than a big picture, you know, issue page or a platform.
Yeah, I agree with you. And the first thing, and I want to end on this because this is right up your alley, is, like, when is America, the populace and electorate, going to understand that when you say, I'm going to call for something that, and, you know, $4.95 will get you a caramel macchiato at Starbucks, it means absolutely nothing, because most of what they're proposing has to go through Congress, and we're probably going to have either a split Congress or razor-thin majorities no matter which way this goes. That's one of those things that always puts my antenna up, is, like, a lot of what they're calling for and their policy platforms, we're getting ready to have the DNC, we had the RNC. Those platforms, almost all that stuff's actually Congress. Very little of that's executive. And yet we listen to them go, I'm like, oh, they're for this. I'm going to vote for them to get that. You're not getting that. You're going to get that through Congress. At some point, maybe the electorate will grow up and do that. But that's one of the things that always kind of grabs me. How's it hit you?
Yeah, I mean, I think people somewhat oversell exactly how much the HBO show Veep is the most accurate show about American politics. I think it's a little bit oversold, but I think it does get a lot of things right. And there's one line in Veep that I always think of when it's, you know, convention season. At one point, Selina Meyer, the president, or, well, vice president, says during the convention, it yells at her daughter, Catherine. She says, it's the party platform, Catherine. It's a to-do list of things that we're not going to do. And so, I do think that there are some, like, changes year over year. If you notice, like, a substantial change in the party platform, that's, like, interesting, that the, you know, committees of people who are in charge of putting out this document decided to nix a certain section. That might be notable, but it's not really, like, a governing document. We're not a system like, I think, like, the United Kingdom parliamentary system, where, you know, if you're in government, you can do what you want. I'm oversimplifying the United Kingdom's parliamentary system. But if you're in government, you can do what you want. Like, we don't have the same thing in the U.S. And even when you are in government and control all of the House, the Senate, and the presidency, you probably don't have that big of majorities in the Senate. So even then, you've got to appease some people.
Yeah, I hear you on that part, because what happens is, I've done UK media before. I was on their live coverage of one of the stations over there's Uvalde coverage. And I was just getting my head kicked in for 30 minutes on the Second Amendment, because I'm speaking a foreign language to them. They're like, well, just pass a gun law, because they're a parliament. And so I'd have to walk them all the way through. I'm like, okay, you're used to the parliamentary system. So with very few exceptions, with a couple of things with the financial budgets, whatever the parliament of the UK says goes. That's the law of the land. They don't have a written constitution. I was like, we have these constitutional amendments, so Congress can pass it all day long and it'll get tied up in court for 5 to 6 years and probably get tore down. I was like, so you have to walk them through it, because it's literally speaking a foreign language to a parliamentary system of, well, why don't you just pass this law? It's like, because we have this layers and we have this, you know, stuff. So it's a well-made point. Alex Marshanu, how'd I do on that one? I get that one?
Pretty good. Hey, yeah.
We're getting there. People can grow. I've grown with you. We're both old Young Voices guys from way back when. Let folks know where they can keep up with you. It's been too long. We'll have you back soon. Appreciate the in-depth conversation on tax stuff, because I know we can geek out on this stuff. A lot of people don't, but I want to give people some stuff they can at least try to get their head around. Tell folks where they can follow you, what you got going on. You've got a couple of really good memes going on Twitter right now at A Hard to Spell. I like the Walmart Hospital one. I'm going to steal that one. Let folks know where they can keep up with you, my friend, until we talk to you again.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Andrew. I can be found on Twitter at A Hard to Spell. And I guess also just go on taxfoundation.org. It's, I write there and I publish work there, but it's also a lot of my my colleagues do as well. And there's a lot of excellent stuff there for you to read. So check those out.
It's funny how it works, too, because I bet you had no clue that no tax on tips was going to eat up your whole fall, did you?
I did not.
It's a funny bit. Alex Marshanu, appreciate the time, sir. We'll talk again real soon. Thanks, you.
All right. Thanks, Andrew.
Yes, sir.
All the music on Her Tell is provided under a creative content license from MonsterCat.com. Somos la máquina.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
Home Club for details.
At Nutrafol, we don't just help your hair, we help your body grow it. Because it's never just about your hair. It can be your job or your deodorant or your lunch or just normal life. That's why our whole body approach targets the key root causes of hair thinning. Discover your root causes and why we're the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com. These statements have not been approved by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease paid for by Nutraceutical Wellness, Inc.